For countless ages, men had dreamed a trip to the moon, but no one had been able to go there except in his imagination. Then at Christmas time in 1968, Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders blazed a trail through space where men had never before ventured. Riding the thrust of a Saturn V rocket, they journeyed 238,000 miles through space, orbited the moon 10 times, photographed and filmed its desolate, barren surface, and returned to describe the epochal voyage. The Apollo 8 mission was a triumph of today's science and technology, and it was a tribute to the vision and determination of the American people who adopted the manned lunar landing as a national goal in 1961. It marked the beginning of a new era, the day when men tore free at last from the grasp of Earth's gravity and entered the sphere of influence of another heavenly body. Like the first flight of Lindbergh across the Atlantic, its primary goal was simply to demonstrate that the trip was possible. Many more trips to the moon will follow. Soon astronauts will set foot on the lunar surface, and after that, men will visit the planets. Although the Apollo 8 mission was a triumph of technology, it was also a boon to the spirit of mankind. Like Lindbergh's flight, it will inspire us to push deeper and deeper into space until the solar system becomes our neighborhood.
6 a.m., December 21st, 1968. The floodlit Apollo Saturn 503 space vehicle is poised like a giant white dart on Pad A of Launch Complex 39 at the John F. Kennedy Space Center. While searchlights reach up from the pad into the star-filled sky, three astronauts, Colonel Frank Borman, Captain James Lovell, and Major William Anders, wait inside the Apollo 8 command module for the climactic moment when the 6-million-pound rocket will lift from the ground. The manned spacecraft's target for the first time in history will be the moon. The countdown proceeds inexorably as the morning dawns. The 363-foot vehicle, breathing forth small white clouds of evaporating fuel, now stands against a pale blue sky. An estimated 250,000 people jam all roads and beaches with a good view of the liftoff. The cape is go.
Apollo 8 mission, 2 minutes and counting. T-minus 2 minutes and counting. We are still proceeding. We now have recorded that the first stage liquid oxygen tank has been pressurized and the pressure is still building up. 1 minute, 45 seconds and counting. We have a vehicle weighing 6.2 million pounds on the pad. Interestingly enough, some 1,200 pounds of that weight is just frost on the side of the vehicle created by the extremely low temperatures of the propellants. 1 minute, 15 seconds. All third stage propellants pressurized at this time as we come up on the 60-second mark on a flight to the moon. Final reports coming from Frank Borman at this time. Final look at the switch list aboard the spacecraft. 35 seconds and counting. We'll lead up to an ignition sequence start at 8.9 seconds. This will lead up as we build up the thrust to a liftoff. If all goes well, it's zero. We just passed the 25-second mark in the count. 20 seconds, all aspects, we are still go at this time. T-minus 15, 14, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9. We have ignition sequence start. The engines are armed. 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. We have commit. We have liftoff. Liftoff at 7:51 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Are clear in 13 seconds. 20 seconds out, we get a loud and clear from Frank Borman.
Apollo 8 Houston, you're looking good. Roger.
Long after Apollo 8 had disappeared, smoke continued to rise from the bereft launch pad. The astronauts entered a near circular orbit 100 miles high. 2 hours and 50 minutes after the launch, Saturn's third stage was to be refired. This operation, called a translunar injection, or TLI, was to send the three men on a trajectory to the moon at 24,000 miles per hour, faster than a rifle bullet, faster than man had ever flown.
Apollo 8 coming up on 20 seconds to ignition. Mark it, and you're looking very good.
Roger.
Ignition.
Roger, ignition.
Fido fly.
Go, Fido.
You look okay?
We look good.
Okay. Look good, Capcom.
Flight booster, all systems go.
Roger.
Flight Fido FG 800 miles, we're go.
Roger. Apollo 8 Houston, we're predicting cutoff 255-58, and that's exactly as it should be.
The space vehicle is now separated from the S-4B, the third stage of the Saturn, which had rocketed the crew out of Earth orbit. Borman reported back exuberantly that they had exceeded Gemini 11's altitude record of 862 miles, set in 1966.
We see the Earth now almost as a disk.
Good show, get a picture of it.
We are.
Bill Conradi lost his record.
We have a beautiful view of Florida now. We can see the Cape just the point.
Roger.
And at the same time, we can see Africa. West Africa is beautiful. I can also see Gibraltar at the same time I'm looking at Florida.
As they viewed the spent S-4B stage, less than 1,000 feet behind the Apollo craft, the men saw great clouds of leftover fuel venting from it. Borman decided to accelerate the spacecraft in order to move away.
Propulsive event, but it's pretty spectacular. It's spewing out from all sides like a huge water sprinkler. I believe we're going to have to thrust away from this thing. We're getting closer.
They were really on their way now, three men in a 12-foot-long cone, which gleams like a star in the sun's rays as it streaks through the black void. Except for two small trajectory corrections, their course was set for the 66-hour trip to the moon. The astronauts monitored their instruments, worried about three of their windows which had clouded up, transmitted television pictures to Earth. They ate, slept, and remained reassuringly close through voice and data communications with Mission Control.
Communications continues to be excellent with the spacecraft. We're continuing to track with the 85-foot dish antenna Goldstone. The crew reported earlier that the signal strength indication that we had was above normal, above what they would expect, and up to this point we have had extremely good results from the unified S-band communication system.
Morning, Mike. How are things going down there?
Well, hi, Jim. Everything's going real fine. How are you going up there? Did you get a good night's sleep?
Well, you know, the first night in space all the time.
I certainly wish we could show you the Earth. It's a beautiful, beautiful view with predominantly blue background and just huge covers of white clouds. Particularly one very strong vortex up near the Terminator. Very, very beautiful.
Happy birthday, Mother.
Right now on the wires is that all 82 crewmen of the Pueblo have been returned. They walked across the Bridge of Freedom Monday night.
Wonderful.
The spacecraft, pulled back by Earth's gravity, gradually slowed to about 2,200 miles an hour. Some 55 hours into the mission, and 176,000 miles from Earth, the moon's gravity began to accelerate the ship. Under these mighty forces, Apollo's course had to be precisely computed so that it would loop around the moon within a few hundred miles of the surface. If all went well, the astronauts were to turn their spacecraft around while they were behind the moon and out of communication with Earth. They would then fire the 20,500-pound thrust engine of the service module in a braking action. This would allow them to be captured in lunar orbit by the moon's gravity. Loss of signal, LOS, would occur when Apollo shot behind the moon. Not until the spacecraft appeared again would ground controllers know whether it was in orbit or whether, failing to orbit, it was returning to Earth.
Apollo 8 Houston, 1 minute to LOS, all systems go. Roger, safe journey, guys.
Thanks a lot, Chris. See you on the other side.
Apollo 8, 10 seconds to go, you're going all the way.
This is Apollo Control Houston. They're traveling over the back side of the moon now. Our velocity reading here, 7777 feet per second. At the present time, we show an altitude above the moon of 293 nautical miles. Apollo Control Houston, we're standing by. We've acquired signal, but No voice contact yet. We're looking at engine data, and it looks good. Tank pressures look good. We have not talked yet with the crew, but we're standing by. We've got it. We've got it. Apollo 8 now in lunar orbit. There's a cheer in the room. This is Apollo Control, Houston. We have a crew report of an orbit of 60.5 nautical miles by 169 nautical miles.
Apollo 8, Houston, what does the old moon look like from 60 miles? Over.
Okay, Houston, the moon is essentially gray, no color. Looks like plaster of Paris, sort of a grayish beach sand. You can see quite a bit of detail. The craters are all rounded off. There's quite a few of them. Many of them look like, especially the round ones, look like hit by meteorites or projectiles of some sort.
Borman, Lovell, and Anders had become the first men personally to view the hidden side of the moon. It was stark, black and white, scarred with ridges, pockmarked by craters. They had also become the first men to view from lunar orbit the Earth rise, blue and white, the only color in the entire void as they emerged from behind the moon. Now, as their track took them over the crescent, sunlit portion of the side facing Earth, the three men looked down on the Sea of Tranquility, prime landing site for future Apollo astronauts. They found they could view the terrain in amazing detail and with excellent depth perception.
Okay, over to my right are the Tierney Mountains coming up, and we're just about over Messier and Pickering right now. Our first initial point is easily seen from our altitude. We're getting quite a bit of contact as we approach the Terminator. The view appears to be good, no reflection of the sun back to our eyes. It appears that visibility at this particular spot is excellent. It's very easy to pick out our first initial point. And over this mountain chain, we can see the second initial point, the triangular mountain.
Roger, Ken.
I can see very clearly the five-crater star formation which we had on our lunar chart.
Most of the near side of the moon, however, was illuminated by light reflected from Earth rather than by direct sunlight.
Apollo 8, Houston, any words on Earthshine, over?
Earthshine is about as expected, Houston. Not as much detail, of course, as in the sunlight, but you can see the large craters quite distinctly. You can see the albedo contacts quite distinctly. And also, there's a good three-dimensional view of the rims of the larger craters.
As they passed over sunlit areas, the astronauts noted central cones in some of the craters and evidence of lava flow. This indicated that radioactivity inside the moon had produced volcanoes. Scientists will be able to tell when the volcanoes occurred by studying volcanic rock brought back to Earth by future astronauts. On each pass over the dark portion of the moon, the stars shone with stark, unglimmering intensity in the blackness of space. Then a lunar sunrise as the spaceship approached the Terminator between darkness and light. A white haze appeared like a bright fan over the spot where, a few moments later, the sun rose. In the lunar day, the sun illuminated the gray lunar surfaces under a black sky. On their third revolution, the astronauts refired their 20,500-pound thrust service propulsion system to change from an elliptical to a nearly perfect circular orbit, 60 nautical miles above the surface of the moon. And back in Houston, it was about 8:30 a.m., Christmas Eve.
Mike, this is Frank again.
So?
Roger, Rod and I got together, and I was going to lay a little prayer for our church service tonight. I wonder if you, I guess that's what we're ready on.
Stand by one, Frank.
All right.
Oh, hey, Houston, go ahead, Frank, with your message.
Okay, this is to Rod Rose and the people of St. Christopher's. Actually, the people everywhere. Give us, O God, the vision which can see thy love in the world in spite of human failure. Give us the faith to trust the goodness in spite of our ignorance and weakness. Give us the knowledge that we may continue to pray with understanding hearts. And show us what each one of us can do to set forward the coming of the day of universal peace. Amen.
The tourists from Earth took 1,200 still pictures and extensive movies during their lunar orbits. Twice they televised the lunar surface passing beneath them to the folks back home. The second TV transmission was about 8:30 p.m. when many people in Houston and elsewhere were putting up their Christmas trees. Apollo 8, beginning its ninth revolution, was about 4 hours away from one of the most critical events of the mission, firing the service propulsion system to leave lunar orbit for home.
Apollo 8 coming to you live from the moon. The moon is a different thing to each one of us. I think that each one carries his own impressions of what he's seen today. I know my own impression is that it's a vast, lonely, forbidding type existence or expanse of nothing. It looks rather like clouds and clouds of pumice stone. And it certainly would not appear to be a very inviting place to live or work. Jim, what have you thought most about?
Well, Frank, it makes you realize just what you have back there on Earth. The Earth from here is a grand oasis of the big vastness of space.
Bill, what do you think? I think the thing that impressed me the most were the lunar sunrises and sunsets.
Actually, I think the best way to describe this area is a vastness of black and white.
We are now approaching lunar sunrise, and for all the people back on Earth, the crew of Apollo 8 has a message that we would like to send to you. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. And God divided the light from the darkness.
And God called the light day. And the darkness he called night. And the evening and the morning were the first day. And God said, "Let there be a firmament in the midst of the waters. And let it divide the waters from the waters." And God made the firmament, and divided the waters which were under the firmament from the waters which were above the firmament. And it was so. And God called the firmament heaven, and the evening and the morning were the second day.
And God said, "Let the waters under the heaven be gathered together into one place, and let the dry land appear." And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering together of the waters called he sea. And God saw that it was good. And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
The SBS engine was to fire Apollo 8 on a trans-Earth trajectory at about 12:10 a.m. Christmas morning, while the astronauts were behind the moon, out of communications with the Earth. If the spacecraft reappeared at 12:19 a.m., as calculated, mission control would know that burn was successful. If it did not appear on schedule, the engine had not fired correctly, and the three men could be stranded in lunar orbit. What a thrill it was when they came around that bend.
Apollo 8, Houston. We have 3 minutes to LOS. All systems are go. Apollo 8, Apollo 8, this is Houston. 3 minutes, LOS. All systems are go. Over.
Roger, thank you, Houston. Apollo 8.
And at 88 hours, 51 minutes, we show loss of signal with the spacecraft. Our next communication with Apollo 8 should come in about 37 minutes. We are now about 28 minutes prior to our trans-Earth injection maneuver. We are now less than 30 seconds to the scheduled time of ignition for the maneuver to start Apollo 8 on its course back to Earth. And here in Mission Control Center, we've just counted down to the burn. We should have ignition at this time. And here in Mission Control, it is relatively quiet, as it has been since we lost communications with the spacecraft as they went over the moon's horizon. At this point, flight controllers here in Mission Control, as with the rest of the world, they are waiting. This is Apollo Control, Houston. We now show less than 30 seconds until reacquisition. We'll stand by for the first words from the Apollo 8 crew as they come over the lunar horizon. We have RF signal, and we should be hearing from the crew shortly.
Apollo 8, Houston. Apollo 8, Houston. Apollo 8, Houston.
Apollo 8, over.
Hello, Apollo 8. Loud and clear.
Roger. Please be informed there is a Santa Claus.
That's a funny. He had a best one to know. Morning, Apollo 8. Speak here. I'd just like to wish you all a very Merry Christmas on behalf of everyone in the control center, and I'm sure everyone around the world. None of us ever expect to have a better Christmas present than this one. Hope you get a good night's sleep from here on, and enjoy your Christmas dinner tomorrow, and look forward to seeing you in Hawaii on the 28th.
Okay, leader, we'll see you there. That was a very, very nice ride, that last one. This engine is as smooth as glass.
Yeah, we gathered that. An outstanding job all the way around.
Well, thank you, everybody on the ground for us. Yeah, it's pretty clear. We wouldn't be anywhere if we didn't have them helping us out here.
That was it. Apollo 8 was coming home, bearing the first lunar explorers in all history.
Apollo 8, this is Houston. Go ahead. Get loud and clear. Is this Bill?
None other.
Yeah, I've got a message for you while you were asleep. Valerie said to tell you she and the kids are leaving for church about 11:30. And eagerly awaiting your return, she says presents are magically starting to appear under the Christmas tree again, so it looks like a double-barrel Christmas. Ellis?
It can't be a deal like that. How was Christmas at your house today?
Early and busy, as usual. I told Michael you guys are up there, and he said, who's driving?
That's a good question. I think Isaac Dutton is doing most of the driving right now.
Would you tell Pete Conrad to get his kids off my roof?
We'll go.
Yes, Houston.
Roger, Dan, you got some bird watchers in the viewing room.
Sounds good. Who are they?
Maryland.
Oh, well, good. Say hello to her for me.
Yes, you got a few troops with her, too.
Did you see the TV? I wonder.
Affirmative. Barbara and Jay are with her.
Apollo 8 came home like a shooting star early in the morning of December 27th, 1968. First, the service module, its duties completed, was fired away. And then the command module, traveling 24,530 miles an hour, began hitting the atmosphere at 400,000 feet, its fiery path taking it to a hard splashdown eventually in the Pacific Ocean, some 1,000 miles southwest of Hawaii. If the reentry angle had been less than 5.1 degrees below the local horizontal, the spacecraft would have skipped back into space. If it had been 7.5 degrees or more, the craft would have burned up. But precisely as planned, Apollo 8 returned at 6.5 degrees, its marvelous heat shield protecting the astronauts against temperatures of 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Night was just turning to day when the spacecraft, slowed by her drogue and main chutes, hit the water less than 5,000 yards from the waiting carrier, the USS Yorktown.
This is Apollo Control, Houston. The report to us from the scene is that the first light of dawn is beginning to show in the east. I'm seeing streaks of light. The capsule is riding very nicely in relatively calm waters. Every console operator is displaying a flag at his desk, very similar to what we saw immediately after the rendezvous in Gemini 6. Everyone applauded, and on one of the loops, we could hear the Star Spangled Banner. And I have never seen the degree of this emotional outpouring in any previous mission, including Alan Shepard's.
And the world applauded. The President of the United States was one of the first to congratulate the three astronauts.
If I could have exchanged thoughts with you, I was going to ask you whether it felt better coming down or going up. And to have you tell me some of your experiences, because you've seen what man has really never seen before. You've taken us, taken all of us, all over the world into a new era. And my thoughts this morning went back to more than 10 years ago in the Pernalis Valley when we saw Sputnik racing through the skies, and we realized that America had a big job ahead of it. It gave me so much pleasure to know that you men have done a large part of that job. So we rejoice that you're well, and we send you congratulations from all of your fellow countrymen and from all peace-loving people in the world. Well done.
After debriefings aboard the carrier and a joyous return to their families in Houston, the three men addressed a joint session of Congress in the nation's capital.
General recognizes the distinguished gentleman, one of our three brave astronauts, Colonel Frank A. Borman of the United States Air Force, to address the joint meeting.
Thank you very much. Mr. Speaker, Mr. President, members of Congress, and distinguished guests, you're looking at three very grateful and three very humble Americans. And before I make my brief remarks, I would like the honor of introducing to you my colleagues so that they may have the honor of addressing a few brief words to you. I was a little reluctant to do this because on the flight, every time I gave up the microphone, I seldom got it back. But it's my pleasure first to present Captain James Lovell.
Distinguished people from the good earth. Frank, of course, will tell you the thoughts and feelings that we had during our flight. But I did have just one thought, and this thought occurred to me when I came back. I stepped out of the house a few days later and looked up at the moon. And I could scarcely believe that I was there. A sense of pride, a feeling of satisfaction and achievement came over me. And I thought to myself, is there some American in this great country who cannot, when he sees the moon, not feel the same as I do, and say to himself, we were there.
Now I'm not sure I want it back, Jim, after that. And now I'd like to present Colonel Bill Anders.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. As a crew member of Apollo 8, I would like to thank you and the millions of people you represent for making this historic flight possible. As an American, I would also like to thank you for making Apollo 8 the success that it was, and thereby giving our nation and the whole world something to really be proud of. Now, as Frank said, we didn't give him too much of a chance to talk while we were airborne. We're going to give him the floor now, and I'd like to present to you the greatest spacecraft commander the manned spacecraft center has ever seen. Thank you.
Through the wonderful media of television, we of Apollo 8 were able to share with you many fantastic events in the past few days. All the way from the ride on a rocket, Saturn V rocket, that weighed something like 6 million pounds and burns fuel at the rate of 15 tons a second, to a really awe-inspiring view of the Earth as it came over a rugged lunar landscape. Now, the question that we always receive, what was the most indelible view? What do you bring back? What do you remember after this flight? And I must confess that all of us, when we saw the Earth rising over the lunar landscape, said this was it. But being unlikely poets, or not being poets at all, we have to turn to a very distinguished poet. And if I may, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from Archibald MacLeish, because I think it captures the feelings that we all had in moon orbit. To see the Earth as it truly is, small and blue and beautiful in that eternal silence where it floats, is to see ourselves as riders on the Earth together, brothers on that bright loveliness in the internal cold, brothers who know now that they are truly brothers. So the one overwhelming emotion that we carried with us is the fact that we really do all exist on one small globe. And when you get out 240,000 miles, it really isn't a very large Earth. But I think it's also appropriate to recognize the peculiar American contribution to our flight. Certainly, the efforts of the scientists, the engineers, both in the government and in private industry, were immeasurable. And the American workmen, who transformed the formulas, the equations, the thoughts into hardware that to us was a living, breathing, magnificent piece of machinery. To the American workmen, we owe a special debt of gratitude. And I could not sleep tonight if I didn't acknowledge the wonderful support of our people in the Manned Spacecraft Center, the Mission Control Center. For the 6 days, they worked around the clock, 24 hours a day. They guided us, they directed us, they sympathized with us, they even prescribed medicine for us. And in reality, they were the fourth member of the crew. So all of our colleagues who remained on the ground, thank you very much. Now, as you all know, the flight has been very well covered, but there was one significant accomplishment that's gone rather unnoticed, and I'd like to take note of it today, if I may. I think that one of the things that was truly historic that was that we were able to get good Roman Catholic Bill Anders to read the first four verses of the King James Version of the Bible. But now that I see the gentleman here in the front row, I'm not sure we should have read the Bible at all. Progress of today will not be measured by the engineer or the scientist. The question is no longer how to do things, but really how long will we take and how much money will we spend. And I think this is a very sobering thought. What I'm trying to say is that the progress of exploration will be determined not by the scientists or the technologists or the engineers, but rather by the people of this earth. Well, I'd like to leave you with that thought, and of course, the thing that we all feel, that exploration really is the essence of the human spirit. And to pause, to falter, to turn our back on the quest for knowledge, is to perish.